talk with you for a while about the conversion of St. Paul. January the 25th is, as you know, in the calendar of the church, the feast of the conversion of that great and wonderful apostle, St. Paul, the great apostle to the Gentiles. St. Peter and St. Paul were the two pillars of the early church. St. Peter was the Bishop of Rome and the first Pope of the Catholic Church. St. Paul was the great and mighty Apostle to the Gentiles. And this morning I want to talk about his great and wonderful conversion. Probably there is no other event in history, outside, of course, of the events of our Blessed Lord's life and his Holy Mother's life, which have had so much an impact upon human affairs as the conversion of St. Paul and his doings. That brief moment on the road to Damascus, when St. Paul saw a blinding light, and when he turned from a life of hatred of Christ to a life of love and service of Christ, is one of the most dramatic things in all history. And I feel certain that it has had a greater influence on human affairs than all the victories and defeats of Napoleon, than all the rise and falls of empires. Because that one conversion was the foundation of the Catholic Church of the ages. And it was the beginning of Christian civilization. You all know the story of St. Paul, the highly dramatic life of that man. He was a Jew who studied in the rabbinical schools of Jerusalem. He was a legalist who knew the Jewish law thoroughly. And when the Christians arose, he conceived in his heart a great hatred of those people because he saw that they were a threat to the Jewish religion. And so he began his career of persecution of the Christians. He worked under the direction of the chief priests of Israel, and he executed his commissions with great zeal. Wherever there was a Christian community, he went there. And he ruled them out. And he took great delight in putting them into prison, and in some case, of having them killed. But an event happened in Jerusalem one day when Saul, because his Jewish name was Saul, when he was near the Damascus gate of Jerusalem, and he saw a great crowd of people with stones in their hands in pursuit of a young man. And he went up, and this crowd got the young man, and they threw him down into a pit. And then they stoned him, and kept on stoning him, till he was dead. And this young man was St. Stephen, the first martyr of the church. And St. Paul stood in the outskirts of that crowd, and watched the death of this young man. And he saw that in the last moments of this young man's life, that he looked up toward heaven, and he seemed to be talking to somebody there in the heavens. And he used the name Jesus, the holiest of all names. And somewhere down in the subconscious mind of St. Paul, and probably in his conscious mind as well, the memory of this event was stored up. And it began probably working inside of him. And then one day, St. Paul was told to go to Damascus because news had come to Jerusalem that there was a considerable community of Christians in Damascus. And Paul went up there with a party, riding horseback, and they got within sight of Damascus, near the Damascus gate. And then suddenly, St. Paul saw in front of him a blinding light. And he was so strong that he fell down from his horse to the ground. And then from that light he heard a voice. And the voice said, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? And Saul said, Who art thou, Lord? And the voice said, I am Jesus, whom thou persecutest. And in that moment of the blinding flash, the whole life of this man changed. The hatred all went, and in where the hatred had been, there came a conviction that at last he was in touch with truth, absolute truth. And in that moment, Paul gave his life, his poor broken life, into the hands of Jesus. And for the rest of his life, he lived in the memory and under the power of that blinding moment. So that at the end of his life, he could say those glorious words, Lord, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. And that began the career of this wonderful man. The career of Paul, the great apostle of Jesus Christ. The great foundation of the Church of the Ages. It would be hard to find in all history a man of a more varied career. St. Paul had a profound and sharp mind. His mind was the sort that could see into the depths and the profundities of philosophy and theology and the truth. He had a spiritual insight that could probe immediately to the heart of a matter. He had a wonderful knowledge of human nature in all of its ramifications. And all of his talents he gave to our blessed Lord. And from the moment of his conversion on, St. Paul never had any interest except the interest of his master. That and that alone dominated his life. He had a single-track mind. St. Paul had no hobbies. Everything that he was and everything that he hoped to be was centered in the Lord Christ. For Christ, he was willing to undergo anything, whatever it might be. Persecution, illness, anything, anything for Christ. And he suffered terribly. St. Paul was not a robust man. What his illness was, we don't know, but he was a man who suffered much sickness. Probably St. Paul, in many of those wonderful sermons that he preached around the Roman Empire, probably he was running a temperature of 104 or 105 degrees. It's quite possible. He slept anywhere on the ground chiefly. He was often, perhaps usually, hungry. He never asked anything material of anybody. And in order that he might not be an imposition on the Christian community, he worked as a tent maker, sewing canvas, making tents, and making a few pennies for his material needs. He suffered everything. He knew the inside of several Roman jails. He was thrown out of cities. On one or two occasions, his body was left unconscious and bleeding on the road. He was kicked and buffeted and slandered. But he never complained. He bore it all for Christ's sake. He suffered shipwreck. He suffered beatings, scourgings. He once spoke of 40 stripes save one that were on his back as heavy welts. But all of that was a joy to him because it was for Christ's sake. He was afraid of nobody. He was afraid of nobody, nothing, because he had always in his heart the feeling that Christ was with him. He was a lame man, badly crippled in one leg. And after his conversion, when he was riding horseback, he probably walked everywhere. He walked thousands of miles, tens of thousands of miles, down the straight roads of the Roman Empire. He wanted to go everywhere to preach Christ. He drove himself continually. He lived on his nerves. Also, he suffered from inner qualities. St. Paul was not the type of saint who was mild and placid and calm. He was anything but calm. He had a very high temper, and he lost it very often. Those of you who have high tempers, take courage. St. Paul had one too, and his was a towering one. He was often misunderstood. He had very little patience. He did not suffer fools gladly. But he went on and on and on for Christ's gentle sake. In the early church, there came a great crisis. The church was small, and remember, the early church was composed mainly of Jews. But when St. Paul was converted, St. Paul went for the non-Jews. He saw what Christ meant, to go forth and preach the gospel to every creature. And so he went and he preached to the Greeks, he preached to the Romans, he preached to everybody. And he saw that the church of Christ, down through the ages, would be a church embracing all men of all races, of all languages, of all cultures. He had no time for narrow Judaistic prejudices. But most of the apostles had a belief that Christianity was a sort of a development of Judaism, and that it was meant only to be a sort of a sect of Judaism. And they believed that when these Gentiles, these non-Jews, became Christians, that not only must they be baptized, but if they were males, that first of all they must be circumcised and then baptized. St. Paul said no. They also, the majority of the apostles and the Christians of that age, felt that all non-Jews who became Christians had to keep the Jewish law, including the dietary laws. As you know, Jews have to keep very elaborate dietary laws. And so most of the apostles and most of the Christians wanted to force upon the Gentiles, upon the non-Jews, the keeping of the Jewish laws, and for the males, the rite of circumcision. St. Paul said, no! Christ's gospel has nothing to do with the Jewish law. The Jewish law is finished. Christ's faith is the faith for all men everywhere. And so there was a bitter dispute in the church. Now, St. Peter was on the other side. I want to repeat that, because in this day and age, when we traditional Catholics are told about obedience, the apostate church over there, they're always haranguing us about obedience. Not that they obey anybody or anything, except their own inclinations. But they talk about obedience to the Pope. All right, the first Pope of the Catholic Church was St. Peter. And I want to emphasize this, St. Peter was on the wrong side. And St. Paul rebuked him publicly in front of all the apostles. But St. Peter, I preached here the last time I was here, I believe, on St. Peter. And I pointed out that St. Peter often failed Christ badly, but he always came back. He always came back. St. Peter was Christ's man. He belonged to Christ. And on this issue too, when St. Paul convinced him, St. Peter wonderfully and nobly acknowledged that St. Paul was right. And so this dispute came up in the early church. Now those who urged circumcision and the keeping of the law felt that Christianity was just an adjunct to the Jewish religion. a sort of a slightly heretical sect. At least that's what the Jews thought. But it was part of Judaism. And so they said, those said, let's make an accommodation with the old religion. Now, Judaism had failed. In modern slang, it had missed the bus. The only purpose of the Jewish religion was to conserve the hope for the Messiah and bring forth the Messiah. But when the Messiah came, the Jews did not accept him, except those who were in the Christian church. So Judaism had passed. But they talked to the Christians about obedience. You must obey. You must obey the chief priests. Have we heard that somewhere? I think we have, haven't we? You must obey. St. Paul said, we obey God. We obey the true faith. And so Christianity broke the ties with Judaism. It refused to make any compromise. It refused to make any accommodation. Do you see what I'm getting at? Aren't we in a similar situation today? The apostate Roman Catholic Church has missed the bus. It was their job to conserve the Holy Catholic faith down through history and never give in, never compromise. And they did compromise. They gave in to the world. They made an accommodation with the world. And so they have missed the bus. And the truth has passed, the keeping of the truth has passed to the remnant. The remnant. And the Roman Catholic Church today consists of traditional Catholics who have kept the faith and who have refused to compromise or give in. We shall not give in. We shall not compromise. We stand in the Roman Catholic truth of the ages, and there we shall stand. And Mary Immaculate, Queen of Heaven, Mother of Mercy, Mother of Good Counsel, help us to be strong. Help us to keep the faith. Help us to be firm and never compromise, not one single inch. God, help us to be strong and keep the faith, the holy faith of our fathers, the faith of the Roman Catholic Church of the ages. We're in the same situation as St. Paul. St. Paul's answer to Judaism was no. Our answer to those who have given up the faith is no. Here we stand and here we continue to stand on the true faith. Another thing that faced St. Paul, when he went out to preach the gospel of Christ, he preached in a world that was morally bankrupt. A world that was depraved, degenerate. The great trouble with the world in which St. Paul preached, the great moral trouble, was that sex had become the dominant theme in the minds of mankind. And that's what's happened in the age in which we are. This age, like the age of St. Paul, is saturated with a misconception of sex. Sex has become a sort of a degraded, perverted religion of mankind. In St. Paul's day, the old Roman religion had passed. It was finished. The Romans, at their heyday, had had a fairly moral life. They had a sense of family, a sense of decency, a sense of the law. But that had passed, and corruption had come over the earth, over the empire. All sorts of mystery religions had come from the banks of the Nile and the banks of the Euphrates. And these mystery religions were largely centered around the theme of sex. In Ephesus, where St. Paul spent 2 years, there was a great temple of Diana, the goddess Diana. And these great temples of female goddesses were usually sort of temples of sex. This great temple of Ephesus in Diana, I've stood in the ruins of it, was a great sex symbol in the city. It had a whole prostitution trade in connection with it. This sort of thing was rampant. The age was mad on the theme of sex. And St. Paul had to preach in that age. And he hated it. And that's why in so many of his epistles you find these long series of dissertations on the subject of morality and the perversion of man's instincts. St. Paul was very conscious of all that horror of the age. And this is a similar age. Malcolm Muggeridge, in a speech that I heard him give once in Canada, in Hamilton, I think it was, yes, made this statement. He said, along this line, he said, in this particular age, we are flooded with pornography. The minds of men are captured by pornography. And this pornography stimulates all the baser instincts of mankind. And then the product of this, exaggerated sexuality and pornography, is cut off by the pill and by abortion. And he said, our society balances between pornography and abortion. And it's a sick, diseased society. In this age in which we're living, it's horrible to think of the organized slaughter of innocent babies by their mothers. Isn't that the most hideously degraded, deformed, sick thing you can think about? And in this society, pornography is poured like one great open sewer across our society. I lived for a number of years in Spain. And the years that I lived in Spain were when General Franco was dictator, when he ruled the country. Now, I have no brief for General Franco in political terms. I'm not a believer in dictatorships or anything of that sort. I'm a Democrat. Not the Democratic Party, that is correct. Democrat with a small D. Not with a capital D, God forbid. I shouldn't talk politics today. At any rate, General Franco was dictator in Spain. Well, now, whatever might be said against General Franco or for him, he was a very good Catholic. An extremely good Catholic. He went to Mass every day of his life. For 30 or more years of his life, he carried with him in a silver case the arm of St. Teresa of Avila, which had been captured from the communist troops in the Civil War. He took that everywhere with him. He kept it in a special suitcase. He prayed before it every night. He was a very devoted Catholic. And while he was in power in Spain, he kept Spain on a course of good morality. There was no civil divorce. There was no abortion. There isn't abortion even yet, but there's civil divorce. He kept the films, the only films that he allowed in Spain were consistent with good morality. None of these green movies, Swedish movies, that sort of thing. The television was strictly censored. The costumes that people wore in the beach resorts, that was censored too. So he kept Spain on a good course. Well now, 5 years ago, I was in Lourdes in France over the Feast of the Assumption. I spent 2 weeks there. And I thought I'd go down to Spain to spend a week in Zaragoza, where I had lived for 1 year of my 8 years in Spain. And to get down there, I had to take buses and slow trains, and then I finally got to the Spanish frontier. And I crossed from France into Spain in a French bus to the railway station of Candanchu. And I had nothing with me to read except my breviary. So I went down, I found I had to wait 8 hours there to catch a train for Zaragoza. I had nothing to read, so I went down to the magazine rack at the end of the station. Now remember, I had not been in Spain since General Franco had died. So I went down there and looked at this magazine rack. And I stood there unbelieving. I have never in my life seen such raw, total pornography as I saw on the front of almost every magazine on that rack. And that had happened in an incredibly short time. I think General Franco then had been dead 2 years. And in that 2 years,
the country that Catholic Spain had been flooded with pornography. Remember, pornography in this country alone is a $1 billion industry. And in the world at large, it must be a multi-$1 billion industry. And they got in Spain that quickly and corrupted the country. So, in this age, when we preach the gospel of Christ, when we try to establish or reestablish His Holy Roman Catholic Church, we have to try to do it in this paganized, sex-saturated society. And that makes it an immeasurably harder job. But St. Paul won out, and we shall win. Our campaign against pornography, our campaign, our crusade against abortion, I'm sure that we shall win, because God is on our side and our Blessed Lady is helping us at every step. I've been through the countries where St. Paul preached 3 times, or at least I've visited there 3 times, and all in all, I've followed in quite a lot of the footsteps of St. Paul, through Asia Minor, through Syria, through Greece, through Cyprus, through all that part of the world. I remember so vividly the day that I went to Tarsus, where St. Paul was born. Now, when St. Paul was born there, Tarsus was a great cultured Roman Greek city, a great seaport. Today, it's a dusty, dirty, miserable town, a Turkish town, all Mohammedan practically. I think there are a few Armenians still live there. But I took a bus in Adana, which is about 40 kilometers away, and went to Tarsus. And the bus drew up in a cloud of dust in front of the Singer Sewing Machine Agency. Singer Sewing Machines are as ubiquitous as Coca-Cola, probably much more useful. So I got out of the bus. I didn't know a word of Turkish. The guidebook that I had with me had in it nothing about St. Paul. So I wondered how I was going to find something in Tarsus which had connection with St. Paul. So when I was standing there wondering what I was going to do next, not knowing any Turkish, a boy of about 13, 14 came up to me, Turkish boy. And he said to me in English, he said, "May I help you, sir?" So I regarded him as a godsend. I said, "Yes." His English was not up to much, but he could speak it and he could understand it. So I said, "Yes, can you tell me anything that there might be here in Tarsus which has any connection with St. Paul?" He said, "St. Paul? Who was he?" So I couldn't believe this, that anybody could live in Tarsus and not know who St. Paul was. So I repeated the Greek word for St. Paul, Aios Pavlos. He looked at me blankly and said, "I don't know any Arabic except a few words," but I said in the Arabic word for St. Paul, Mokandas Bolas. He still looked blankly at me. He said, "St. Paul, I've never heard of him." And I felt depressed. Here I was in Tarsus, the birthplace of St. Paul. And here was a son of Tarsus in front of me who had never heard of Tarsus' greatest son. But I did find some things in Tarsus that day by probing around that were there in St. Paul's day, some ruins and so on. And I went to so many places where St. Paul had preached. I went to Konya, the Turkish town of Konya, which in St. Paul's day was the Roman Greek city of Iconium. And St. Paul had been run out of that town by the authorities, and they left his body there unconscious and bleeding on the road. I went to Ephesus, where the great temple of Diana, that great sex center was, where St. Paul had caused a riot. St. Paul was good at starting riots. He was that sort of person. Where he went, there were riots. Riots for Christ. Or against Christ, but he won every time. I went to Alexander Troas, where he had a vision of a man who said, come over into Europe, to Macedonia, and help us. I went to Athens, where he preached on Mars Hill, that great sermon about the unknown God. I went down the roads of Cyprus, where he and St. Barnabas had preached on their first missionary journey. Although at that time Cyprus was full of bullets and one had to be careful. And finally, I went to a seminary in Rome, which was right in front of the great church of St. Paul outside the walls, where his executed body was buried. And when I was that year at seminary in Rome, I used sometimes to walk down the road. And about a kilometer and a half down the road was a place known as the place of the three springs. Tre Fontane. And on the 29th of June, in the year 67 A.D., St. Paul, who was an old man, and who was in chains, a prisoner of the Roman Empire, he was arrested along with St. Peter. And St. Paul was taken by his guards, chained. He was marched through the Ostian Gate, down the Via Ostia, which leads toward the port of Rome. And there at the place of the three springs, Tre Fontane, he knelt down under the eucalyptus trees, and a Roman sword severed his head from his body. And you know, I think that in that last moment, St. Paul looked up to heaven. And I think the words that must have come to his mind were those wonderful words, Lord, Lord, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. Dear blessed St. Paul, may he be with us in these troublous times in which we live. These times of apostasy and immorality and dirt. These times of a lack of faith. When our whole society seems to be engulfed by horrors. St. Paul won out in a world where every odd was stacked against him. And through the grace of God and the help of his blessed mother, we too shall win in the spirit of dear, blessed St. Paul. May he be with us always. In the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.